Federal rules touch all areas of our life, from the food we put in our mouth, is that really organic, to the airbags in our cars, and what's in the paint that's on our walls, and that's just to name just a few. The process of how a rule takes shape after it's passed into law is really fascinating. And as we start the new year, we're going to explore federal rulemaking and the public comment aspect of the process. Susan Yockey is a professor of public affairs and political science at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs and director of the La Follette School's Board of Visitors. She's an expert on the policymaking process and regulation. Susan, thanks so much for coming in.
Great. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, let's start with the basics. What is federal rulemaking?
So after we pass a law, let's say it's at the national level in the United States, typically that law gets sent on to the appropriate substantive administrative agency to implement. In the words of one Supreme Court case, to quote, fill up the details, end of quote, of what could be incomplete or maybe even vague congressionally passed legislation. And that next process, that process of detail filling, is rulemaking.
How does that process work?
Well, in 1946, at that point in history, there already were some examples of administrative agencies being called upon to fill in details, but there wasn't a real clear process by which agencies did that. And there really wasn't a transparent process for agencies to do that. So in 1946, Congress passed a statute called the Administrative Procedure Act, and that statute sets up a process for all federal agencies to implement agency regulations. And interestingly, subsequent to that federal statute, most of our 50 states have passed similar statutes to write rules and regulations in the states.
Have those rules and regulations over the decades stayed pretty consistent in terms of how this whole process works?
Well, that's a really interesting question. So let me say that the vast majority of agency regulations follow the process. And this gets into a little bit of a detail as to what do we really call a regulation or a rule. But the vast majority of rules are passed through something called the notice and comment process, which was set up in the APA. That's that Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. And the notice and comment process requires that all federal agencies publish a draft regulation. And I'm a professor, so you can think about this like a draft student paper, right? It's not final. It's got everything it needs or ought to.
Lots of red marks, perhaps.
And then the red marks are supposed to come from the public.
Ah.
So the public, that draft regulation gets publicly announced. And there's a window of time when anybody, you, I, an interest group, a business, a regulated entity, can submit public comments on how an agency ought to change that draft rule.
So people often say that politicians writing laws on things they don't have experience with, like healthcare, it seems like our bureaucracy is constructed so that experts are actually filling in all these details, as you talk about. Is that always the case, or does all congressional legislation go through the rulemaking process, or just certain laws?
That's a great question. Only certain laws do, and I'll call it the majority of laws do. There are certain circumstances when a particular member of Congress or a congressional committee just has a lot of expertise in that particular area and wants to be really clear, and then the rulemaking process isn't as necessary.
So how important are the comments, the public comment period on this rulemaking and these red marks, so to speak?
Yeah, so scholars differ on how important the comments are. But let's talk about it from just a good government standpoint first. This is a terrifically transparent process. Compare it to our legislative process. We don't have in the United States a situation where draft legislation has to first go out for public comment and people get to comment on it before our Congress finalizes the piece of the pieces of legislation that would dramatically change our legislative process. In contrast, in our regulatory process, we do. We have a situation where citizens get to share their views, and they also get to stay abreast of what government agencies are doing simply through the submission of draft rules, the taking of public comments, and then the finalization of those rules.
You've researched whether these comments make an impact. What did you find?
So, you know, it's really tricky to, and I'll just do my scholarly caveat first. It's tricky to establish causality, that the comments actually cause changes. But I have used a number of different analytic strategies to try to get at this really, really important question. And so I have used content analysis to compare the text of those draft rules to what is finalized and looked for changes. And oftentimes the public comments, the topics, the concerns, the recommendations that are made in the public comments are where the changes are taking place. And frequently you will see the government agency in the final rule say, listen, we got 10 comments or we got 100 comments on this particular issue, and they're right. We're going to make this shift. We're going to make this change in the text of the final rule. So you certainly see very suggestive evidence of it occurring, as well as government regulators saying that it is occurring.
Talking right now with Susan Yockey. She is a professor of public affairs and political science at the UW-Madison La Follette School of Public Affairs. And we're discussing the federal rulemaking process, how rules take shape in our American life here, and what your comments have to do about it. Have you ever participated in the federal rulemaking process by submitting a comment during the public comment period? Do you plan on being a more active participant in the rulemaking process in the future? 800-642-1234. What are your questions about federal rulemaking? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Susan, is being officially open to public comments for agencies, is that a way for agencies to perhaps shield themselves from the risk of litigation or shield themselves from the risk of making a real big, a big boo-boo on a rule?
Yes and yes. So let me separate those two things. On the side of taking in comments to get good ideas, absolutely. So I've done a lot of interviewing with agency regulators, both at the national level as well as here in Wisconsin. And many of them will say that through the public commenting process, they receive new ideas or new ways to implement government policy. You will sometimes see proposed rules that are completely pulled back after they have public comments taken because the public commenters have revealed something that was so problematic that the agency completely reconsiders their approach. And so you do have examples of that. And you certainly have regulators seeing the value of the public commenting process from that standpoint. On the judicial side, it is also the case that public comments, due to the fact that the rulemaking process is set up by statute and agencies are confined to that Administrative Procedures Act of 1946, that requires that the comments be at least considered. And the courts police that process. They require that the agency officials at least consider those public comments. And what that often means is that in the final rule that's issued by the agency, even if a public comment isn't a change isn't made in reply to the public comment, the agency official oftentimes explains their reasoning for why, which I think is important from a governance standpoint.
Are there recent examples of regulations that were actually shaped by public opinion in the end?
That's a really good question. So in some of my current research, I'm doing work in the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or what commonly called the FDA. And the FDA is a huge rule writer in the United States. By the FDA's own count, regulated products account for about 20 cents of an American dollar spent is spent on FDA-regulated products today. So this is a huge impact in American life. And I've been doing some research on a set of FDA rules. One of them is on menu labeling in restaurants. And so this is nutrition labeling that you might see on calorie content and other kind of nutritional benefits that may accrue through purchased food at chain restaurants, so typically restaurants of 20 or more. And that rule has some evidence of comment or influence.
Last month, a federal judge in Seattle partially blocked the Trump administration's ban on certain refugees from 11 countries, ruling that the order violates federal rulemaking requirements. Susan Yockey is here. She's a professor of public policy and political science at UW-Madison. We are discussing the federal rulemaking process. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your question about how rules are made in this country? Join in the conversation. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll return after a check of the latest news. A federal appeals court is ordering the Environmental Protection Agency to take action within 3 months to revise rules meant to protect children from lead-based paint. A federal appeals court said the EPA has taken too long to act on a 2009 petition from health and environmental groups who want the agency to further restrict lead paint limitations. The EPA told the court that it would take another 6 years to develop a lead paint rule, which the judges did not accept. This is relevant to our conversation. We're talking about the federal rulemaking process, sometimes slow, sometimes a bit faster, a process with public input on this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Susan Yockey is an expert on public policy and political science professor at UW-Madison. Your questions and insights on federal rulemaking at 800-642-1234. Do you think rulemaking should be a more expedited process? Do you think public comments are a necessary part of the rulemaking process? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Susan, in the case here, this federal appeals court said the EPA was just unacceptable in coming up with a new rule. Is that rare for a court to step in and say, hey, look, agency, you got to be faster on your feet here?
It's not particularly rare, especially with, let's call them big, important rules. The courts play a pretty active role. Occasionally, within congressional law, Congress will have deadlines for rule activity, either the creation of one of those draft regulations, the early document, or the creation of a final rule, that if agencies don't hit those targets, those deadlines, they are quite open to court action to ask that they reconsider and move faster on their regulatory activity.
Let's take a call now. Let's go to Steve, who joins us from Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I know, you know, one of the things that came up, I want to say 2 years ago, 2016 and Obama's last year, was the, you know, Congress wasn't going to do anything about changing the exempt to non-exempt status of employees. That would have been a very pervasive impact on our companies and the employer-employee relationship. And the Obama administration made no secret that they wanted that change. And, you know, they rammed through some rule changes regardless of what the public input is. And that, I think, if I remember correctly, it went to court, and the court said they put it on hold, and ultimately Trump was elected and the whole thing was scrapped. But how often does that happen where an administration just tries to ram through rules regardless of public comment just because they think it's politically expedient?
It happens with some frequency, especially with the turnover of this recent presidency. There is some scholarly research into what you might call midnight regulations. Those are the regulations that are passed in the last hours of a presidential administration. They tend to be somewhat more controversial, and they tend to be rushed. In those circumstances, you could see where public comments might not be utilized to the highest degree. I will say that those are also the cases where judicial review is a check on the executive's power to write rules and regulations. If comments are considered, if agencies are acting in a, quote, arbitrary and capricious, unquote, manner, they are much more likely to see their rules overturned, either due to procedural issues, they didn't follow the proper notice and comment process, they didn't consider the public comments, or due to most substantive issues, such as they may not have had the statutory authority to actually write the rule in the first place.
Steve, thank you so much for calling in with that question. Susan, what has been the Trump administration's approach to federal rulemaking and its philosophy?
So you may recall that one of the big issues of the Trump campaign was the regulatory state, and thinking that the regulatory state was too large, needed to be pulled back, reined in, and it was a big talking point for now President Trump. And there's been a fair amount of evidence that there's been activity amongst the Trump administration in fulfilling that campaign promise. One of the first executive orders from President Trump was Executive Order 13777, which passed in January of 2017. And that's the executive order that requires that for significant federal agency rules to pass at the national level, for every one new rule, two rules need to be identified to be taken off the books. And that's a major change. We're still seeing how that's being implemented, but that was a major change that was instituted by the Trump administration.
Is that even possible?
It is possible. I will say that the Trump administration's executive order focuses and has to focus on more cabinet-level agencies, so independent agencies such as the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, are not bound by this new executive order. And the way that the Trump administration is implementing the executive order does have some benefits for society. And one of those benefits is that all rules and regulations are going to have a closer accounting of both the costs and the benefits. In the past, major regulations, especially economically significant regulations, had to have such an accounting. And now all significant regulations will have that type of accounting. And from an analytics standpoint, I believe it's good if we have a broader sense of both the costs and the benefits, importantly, and the benefits of rules and regulations before they're implemented.
We're going to get to the FCC's net neutrality issue in just a moment. But generally speaking, are most people aware of the fact that they can share their opinions with federal agencies in this manner?
I don't think so. You know, there's a lot of rules and regulations that elicit no public comments. You know, they may be less significant regulations, and so maybe they are less important to the American public. But regardless, rules on clean water, clean air, child car seats, health care, financial markets, all of these types of topics that are pivotal to American life touch the rulemaking process as well. And so in that sense, it is surprising that we see relatively few Americans participating. The majority of participants tend to be interest groups.
Let's bring in Laura now in Menominee Falls. Hi, Laura.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is two parts. It seems like public comments lend a lot of good to the process overall. So I am wondering if there's ever been an effort to have a minimum public comment period so that people can weigh in on different legislation. And then secondarily, has there been an effort to make it easier for people to weigh in? For example, right now, if I want to contact one of my elected officials, I call their local office, their national office, but I have to call each elected official instead of maybe one place to call where my comments are heard and perhaps on the other end accessed more easily by my elected officials?
That's a great question. And I don't know of a similar process at the, if we think about the, on the Congress side. Members of Congress typically, as your question stated, have their own processes for bringing in constituent feedback, integrating that constituent feedback into their votes and into their positions. And we also have, frankly, elections that police that process. And that's, you know, if we think about the fact that most administrators in agencies are not elected officials, it's one of the reasons why it's so important that public feedback be integrated into the regulatory process. Agency rules are legally binding, just like pieces of legislation are legally binding on you and I. And because of that, we need to have a heightened responsibility and accountability to the public. And we accomplish that through the notice and comment process. On the regulatory side, there is a pretty easy way. It's a really great website. It's called regulations.gov. That's regulations.gov to participate in almost all federal rulemaking activities. That site will let you search for all rules that are open for public comment right now. It also is a great repository for rules that have been relatively recently finalized. You can see the types of folks that commented. You can look at the proposed rule. You can look at the final rule. And you can draw your own judgments as to whether the comments were adhered to or not.
Laura, thank you for calling in with that question. Mitchell tweeted us at WPR Mornings and asks, Susan, do you have any thoughts on whether it's easier to establish a rule or to modify or reverse a rule at a later date? And if so, what are the implications on getting it right the first time?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think with all public policy, the first time around is really difficult. Establishing the basis, establishing the scientific evidence, which is required as part of the rulemaking process, can be difficult, especially in an area that is relatively contentious. And so once that scientific basis is put within a particular rule, it does make it trickier to reverse that rule in the future. To take rules and regulations off the books at the national level in the United States, you have to go through the whole rulemaking process again. So to deregulate, you have to go through the notice and comment process, which requires, again, a draft rule, the taking of public comments, and a final rule. And those public comments, if you're trying to reverse a rule, will oftentimes say, why are we changing this? The first rule record had it a different way. And the courts are quite important in that process, making sure, again, that agency decisions are not made in an arbitrary and capricious manner.
Well, last year, there were over 20 million public comments submitted in response to the FCC's regulation to overturn net neutrality rules. What did we learn from those comments? 20 million.
Yeah, we learned a lot. And let me put this in two different buckets for us. So one, let's talk about the process. So I'm a scholar of the policymaking process. And we're always looking for ways to improve the process, reform it, to make it better adhere to citizens' views. And from the standpoint of 22 million comments for the FCC's rule on net neutrality, that's a lot of information to digest. And we found through that process, and there's been a lot of investigative reporting on the content of some of those comments and trying to match up the actual people who made the comments, that we may need to have some revisions to the commenting process to better identify and make sure that real citizens are providing the comments, making sure that those citizens are locatable, both with addresses and contact information, to ensure that this process of taking comments matches citizens' views and citizens' feedback, and not the feedback of bots or some other kind of automated technology that may allow for kind of instantaneous commenting.
In November, the Pew Research Center revealed potential issues with the efficacy of the input. Pew found that 57% of comments had duplicate or temporary email addresses. 94% of them were submitted repeatedly, sometimes hundreds of thousands of times. The Pew Research Center also found thousands of comments were submitted at precisely the same moment. Terry from Rhinelander wonders, he couldn't stay with us. He says, does the public comment period have integrity?
I think we're going to need to do some more work on that very issue. About 15 years ago, say 20 years ago, commenting online and commenting sort of instantaneously to agency websites was a brand new thing, and it was going to further democratize the rulemaking process. And I think there's still a lot of promise there. We need to have more efforts to open up and make rules clearer, easier, less complex, and more readily available to real citizen feedback. Now we're seeing the flip side of that, and that is that we've made the process so easy and we've made the process so, in some ways, unaccountable that in efforts to increase citizen feedback, that we probably need to put some backstops into that process to ensure that we're getting real citizen feedback. And I think that's one of the governance lessons that has been revealed through the FCC net neutrality process.
It seems net neutrality put federal rulemaking in the spotlight. There were protests around the country. There was so much interest in what the FCC body would vote, how they would vote. What did you take away from that in terms of your scholarly research on federal rulemaking through the years?
I think over the years, we have seen increased public attention to certain rules. And, you know, part of that is that we're, to some degree, governance is becoming more complicated. You know, Congress, in past Congresses hasn't passed a large number of public laws. In fact, one recent count said that there was about 3,000 notice and comment regulations. And at the same time period, there were only which equated to about 30 rules for every piece of congressionally passed legislation. That would have been in 2015. And because of that kind of statistic, by definition, we're going to have more political issues attached to the rulemaking process. When Congress passes more authority on or delegates more policymaking authority on to agencies like the FCC, they're by definition going to be making issues and decisions on more politically charged topics. And I think that's one of the lessons we've seen in the rulemaking process over the last 15 years. More and more tough political problems that are being solved in the rulemaking process as opposed to the legislative process.
We're right now with Susan Yockey. She is a public policy expert and a political scientist at UW-Madison. We're discussing the federal rulemaking process. Your comments and questions about federal rulemaking are welcome at 800-642-1234. How do you think the FCC approached net neutrality rules? Do you think people's comments are being taken to heart when it comes to the overall rulemaking process? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Susan, are these agencies equipped to fill out these rules, to take legislation and really put the framework in there and all of the specifics that are required? Are these agencies equipped to do that?
Generally speaking, yes. I mean, we do have most of our federal agencies, the large majority of the people that work there are chosen because of their technical expertise. They're either they're scientists or they're lawyers with particular emphases in substantive areas. They're policy experts. And that is the expertise and the neutral, nonpartisan expertise that's supposed to be brought to the rulemaking process. The agencies are supposed to develop a record of the best scientific evidence. If they don't have the best scientific evidence, they themselves are either to seek it out by asking for research by others or to do research in-house. And that is why there is a critique, and it's a notable and important critique, that the rulemaking process can take too long. That's because building that record takes a lot of time. Appropriately consulting with stakeholders even before the issuance of a draft regulation is quite common now in governance. And all of that process takes time. And that leads or could lead to a mismatch between the level of regulation that society needs and the level of regulation that society has.
What might improve the federal rulemaking system? We're discussing how federal rules are made, how they're created. 800-642-1234. You can join the conversation. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back after a check of the latest news. The Justice Department announced last month that it has started a federal rulemaking process that could reinterpret the legality of certain bump stock devices. That's a piece of equipment that enabled the Las Vegas gunman in October to fire on concertgoers more rapidly, mimicking automatic fire. We're getting a better understanding of how this federal rulemaking works on this Hour of the Morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Susan Yockey is a public policy expert and a political science professor at UW-Madison. Taking your questions on rulemaking at 800-642-1234. Have you ever participated in the federal rulemaking process by submitting a comment? Do you plan on being more active in the rulemaking process in the future? Why or why not? 800-642-1234. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Lori now, who joins us from Vernon County. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering if the professor could explain a little bit more about the cost-benefit analysis. It seems it's somewhat straightforward to figure out how much, you know, it's going to cost to take lead out of the paint. But how do you quantify what, you know, brain damage to children 20 years from now is going to cost? You know, what do you consider in that? And maybe could you also talk about with the precautionary principle? I understand in other places they maybe weigh a little heavily more toward potential damage rather than immediate cost. Thank you.
Yeah, so cost-benefit analysis is a technique used by government regulators as well as state and local governments, local officials, to think about measuring typically by monetizing both the costs of a particular policy versus the benefits. And the caller is absolutely right that thinking about the long-term effects, both the long-term costs and the long-term benefits from public policies is difficult business. And in fact, that is where some of the modeling decisions and the analytic decisions on how to think about, you know, longevity, income brackets, you know, just simply the cost of a human life become extraordinarily tricky and I'll say also controversial. It's, I think, an important technique to try to baseline government decision making, but it can't be the only thing that drives public policy decision making. It should be one of a kind of an arsenal, if you will, of techniques. In terms of the precautionary principle, it is also, you know, if you think about the Environmental Protection Agency, it's a principle that has guided a lot of EPA decision making over time, and that is that we ought to side or err on being having precautions in terms of human health in the future. And, you know, that has been a guiding principle in terms of clean water and clean air standards over the last 25 years.
Lori, great questions. Thanks for calling in. Let's go to George, who joins us from Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Yes, hi. I'm curious as to how whoever's in charge, basically, if we're looking at a federal level, at the White House or at the state level and the governor, if you could perhaps comment on how you think corporate interests might have more influence under certain regimes in writing the rules as opposed to a more kind of a general public comments.
Let's talk about corporate interests sort of generally first. And that is, you know, going back to if you're a federal agency rule writer, you're thinking about, you know, what's the science? What's the research? What's the data tell me? And one of the advantages that a corporate commenter has over most citizen commenters, not all citizen commenters, but most citizen commenters, is that they're able to put within their public comments a lot of detail, a lot of research, technical findings. They may even have particular experience within their business or their regulated entity on trying some of the regulatory approaches, and they're able to share that with regulators. Research has shown that public comments tend to be more emotional, more interested in sort of tone, that they either want more or less regulation. And those are blunter signals that are sent to agency regulators. And because of that, there's likely to be a bias toward public, toward corporate business interest group, trade association comments that are able to put that higher level of detail. And that detail is important both to improve public policy, but also as part of the judicial review process, the courts are looking that agency officials really struggled with that detail, either struggled with it and said, no, we don't agree with you, or struggled with it and said, yes, we do agree with you. And you know, that does put in some tension, this idea of corporate interests or interest group interests versus public interests during the commenting process.
Is it more important, though, to lean toward those corporate interests because of the working knowledge they have of what that rule needs to be or what that rule could be?
Possibly. I mean, we want to think about how regulation can best improve American society. And sometimes that regulation can have negative effects for corporate interests, but have great positive effects for society. And so thinking about whether, you know, those concentrated costs are worth the diffuse benefits is an important job of our agency regulators. And, you know, frequently, corporate interests are seeking out regulation too. It's not as if all corporate interests think all regulation is bad. Many times they simply want certainty. They want to rid the regulatory landscape of uncertainty so they can build their strategic business plans based on a solid foundation.
Oh, it might level the playing field.
It absolutely may level the playing field. Let me up you one and say that some corporate interests want to crowd out competitors. You know, small business interests, especially small businesses, can have a hard time sometimes complying with complicated, burdensome government regulations. And in that case, a very large business or corporation may want a complicated regulatory scheme in order to crowd out competitors or entrants to the market. And that is a negative side of government regulation.
George, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to Roy now, who joins us from Hortonville. Hi, Roy.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you could comment a little bit on the history and the ability of the federal government or even state government to make rules in the first place. It seems as though many years ago there was sort of a standard that there had to be a rational correlation between the conduct that the government was trying to regulate and public good. The best example I can give of that maybe would be the ability of the government to say, well, we're going to put a speed limit on the highway because that's for everyone's good, as opposed to saying, well, you as an individual, if you're an adult, you have to wear a seatbelt. In the first case, it would be for the good of the society. But in the second place, it just seems as though it's a regulation imposed on an individual freedom to make kind of a choice as to what's good for that individual or not.
Well, that's a really interesting question. All of our federal regulations in the United States have to have a statutory basis. So there has to be a piece of legislation or sometimes several pieces of legislation that require that an agency, or at least provide the statutory basis for an agency to write a rule. And so I think most agency regulators would sort of punt on your question and say, we ask our elected representatives in state legislatures or in Congress to make those important trade-offs in governance as to when are we going to limit individuals' freedoms and in and when are we going to impose either sanctions or something, some other kind of government coercion to make citizens do certain behavior. And agency regulators don't make those trade-off choices. Instead, they look to statute to inform them to say, when is a rule necessary? When do we need to fill in some of those technical details in order for the statute to actually be implementable? Now, it's not to say that those details don't matter. They do matter. And in a smaller sense, they're probably making some of those same political trade-offs. But the main authorizing decision would have been made by elected representatives.
Roy, thank you so much for calling in. Susan, recently you've been studying something called administrative guidance or agency guidance documents. What are those?
So just when you thought we were in the weeds, we are going even farther, people. So agency guidance documents are a different tool for agency officials to use to provide policy guidance to mostly the regulated industries, but it affects all of us. And let me contrast these guidance statements with what we've been mostly talking about, and that is rules issued through the notice and comment process. So rules issued by the notice and comment process have been called by some scholars, quote, refreshingly democratic, end of quote. They are, you know, required to take these public commenting, these public comments, they're required to consider them, and they are legally binding when they are issued. In contrast, agency officials will sometimes implement statutes by, instead of going through the notice and comment process, issuing a guidance document. That does not have to go through the same commenting process. It's not legally binding either. So it's clearly, it must actually be labeled clearly not legally binding. But if you ask regulated entities, it oftentimes has the effect of being legally binding. It is, after all, the agency's interpretation of a statute or the interpretation of a notice and comment rule. It oftentimes sets up definitions or ways to implement particular pieces of agency policy. And because of that, some scholars have critiqued agency guidance documents as being a workaround for agency officials. They don't have to take the time to create that big scientific body of evidence to create the rule in the first place. They don't have to take the public comments, and they don't have to consider the public comments. And, you know, that is something that I'm really interested in thinking about the trade-offs for governance, for public participation, for accountability between the tools of notice and comment rules and guidance statements by agency officials.
As we wrap up here, do you see more of these guidance documents coming into our being?
Well, one scholar's estimate is that they are, quote, massive, and that they're used by some agencies, like, for instance, I was mentioning I'm studying the U.S. Food and Drug Administration right now. Some scholarly estimates suggest that the FDA uses guidance statements to a larger degree than notice and comment regulations.
Susan, thank you so much for coming in. This is absolutely fascinating.
I'm delighted that you're interested, and thank you so much for the time.
Susan Yockey is director of the La Follette School of Public Affairs Board of Visitors and professor of public affairs and political science at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs. She studies the federal policymaking process, public management, regulation, administrative law, and interest group politics. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Keely Baltina. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.